Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to episode 75 of The Nero Show. In today's episode,
Matthew Vanderpool signs a 10-year deal with Canyon Bikes. What does this mean for his career?
Selfies, pats on the backs. Why is everyone mates on the podium these days?
We revisit Thomas DeGent's hookless flyer. It was actually a cracked zip rim, so we dig into that.
And how to decipher a YouTube review in terms of buying a bike. All right, let's get into it. We are on air, Jesse Coyle. Can tell because there is a sign that says it.
Neon upgrades.
Neon upgrades live. So I wanted to start with something, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, please.
Matthew van der Poel he's got the bag. He has got the bag of cash, but not from where cyclists normally get their bag of cash, seemingly. As you probably have seen, he has signed a 10-year deal with Canyon, the bike brand, to ride their bikes, essentially, for 10 years. Now, we don't know the financial commitment of this.
Yeah.
I would argue it's probably pretty substantial. But, okay, obviously, the most interesting thing from this, from my perspective, is this usurps any team arrangement he has or would have to align, I suppose, with any team arrangement that he has, because he's also gone and signed, he's renewed or extended with Alpecin De Koninck to 2028 to ride road bikes in the World Tour. At this point, they'll be Canyon road bikes. There's a lot to unpack here, but do you want to what's your original sort of thoughts on this?
No, it's interesting. So he's 29. So he'll be with Canyon until he's 39 years old.
Okay, just while you're quickly thinking about it, can I just quickly read the – so this is the press release from Alpecin De Koninck, right? So Matthew van der Poel has dissolved his current contract with Alpecin De Koninck that ended in 2025 and signed a new deal that will see him racing for the Belgian World Tour team through the end of 2028. After 2028, van der Poel will decide year by year whether to continue as a professional road rider or not, according to the team's press release. So that, again, is separate to the Canyon deal. The statement from Canyon, which sort of clarifies this, is the deal with Canyon does not alter van der Poel's existing deal with Alpecin De Koninck, but instead represents the bike brand's own relationship with the rider and their continued support and collaboration. So again, just goes on top of this fact that this is a separate deal.
So it's 8 years on Alpecin De Koninck, which is a team that was already, he basically built. It was built around him. So up until.
Well, no, there's only 5 years left.
Oh, sorry, 5 years left there.
Correct.
All right. And then he's doing God knows what potentially, but doing God knows what on a Canyon bike.
Correct.
On whatever discipline he then chooses to do. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So there's lots of different ways to then look at it. It's like obviously, oh, okay, well, is that when he then moves to a different team? But obviously that team would then have to have a Canyon bike, or even just like the press release says, maybe it's not even on the road where the future is at that point in his career. I mean, I look at this and I'm kind of always trying to look at similarities between this and other sports. And yeah, this stuff happens where guys sign big brand partnerships outside of the team they're on, but it doesn't impact the team they're on anywhere near as much as it does in cycling. So if Patrick Mahomes signs with Nike, massive brand, that doesn't stop him being traded away from the Kansas City Chiefs to play for the New York Jets. It doesn't matter. Whereas in cycling, it does matter very much where you go, because ultimately you'll be on that equipment and it's just as important. In the cycling space, I've had a bit of a dig around. This hasn't, well, okay, so there was the Sagan situation with Specialized that existed. However, it really ran concurrently or alongside the team arrangements, in the sense that he was, there were always discussions between the Specialized people and the teams that he was going on and all that kind of stuff. So that seemed to be more kind of symbiotic. This is very separate what Canyon have done.
That's a massive life change for him. He's no longer Mathieu van der Poel, the cyclist, choosing his discipline, and Canyon is supporting him. He is now Canyon's child, who tell him, who can pretty much tell him whatever they want to do, and he kind of just has to, he's part of his contract. He has to go wherever they say, or whatever he decides, they kind of have to support. But if it's something ultimately they're not interested in, like if something happened to Appleton de Koenig and he wanted to continue his road career, in 6-7 years' time, and Appleton de Koenig didn't exist, a Canyon team didn't exist, well, he won't be able to do that because he couldn't ride on another team that wasn't supported by Canyon. So it's in one way, this has got to be a very lucrative contract, but I would actually say is, you know, potentially limiting to what he wants to do in a way, depending on how it all falls down. He's got to have equity in Canyon. I mean, this to lock yourself in like this for 10 years over such a long time period, you could just imagine what's going to happen to Canyon's revenue over 10 years. You'd have to think he's got a chunk of the pie to really commit into this. Like, this is a lot further beyond just, we're going to pay you, what, €7 million a year and you'll just be an ambassador? This is a proper lock-in.
Maybe. The other way I looked at it was, so you've heard this chat about potential salary caps. So cycling teams would have salary caps to try and level the playing field. Well, what's a great way around that? You have a salary coming from an entirely different source, and that would potentially then not fit into the budget that was the salary cap.
So they could just pay you in shares and you cash it all out after 10 years.
There you go. Yeah. So, you know, whilst Alpecin de Koenig might have to fit into some UCI-regarded salary cap for their entire team, their best paid, best rider is actually being funded completely elsewhere, sort of leveraging or giving them more salary cap to pump into other riders to support him maybe. So I don't know. I just kind of think there's lots of stuff around that.
Do you reckon, okay, honestly, how much do you think the actual bike played into the decision that Vanderpool's made here? Because that's the angle Canyon will take.
Oh, yeah.
You would say. They're going to say,
yeah,
Mathieu has chosen to partner with us for 10 years, you know, because of the bike. Right? That's what, that's their angle. You know, do you reckon he's gone, I'm happy with this setup? I mean, I think I'll answer first. I think he'd be very happy with their Ranger bikes.
That's the key word there is range. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, yeah, Colnago would be a really nice bike to ride, but what's their mountain bike like, and their cross bike and their gravel bike and all these other things that he wants to perform at the very highest? Canyon's going to do that for him. Yeah, it probably does play. I reckon they've done this really well. Yeah, it's a really good play. But my thing with this is a play way bigger than we're just going to have him ride bikes for a couple more years on our thing. I feel like this is we're going to have him as part of the Canyon family for 30 years. Like, this is into retirement. He's got the Canyon T-shirt on. He's doing Mathieu van der Poel, Fondo rides all over the world in the US. He is Canyon for life now.
Have you seen this done? Okay, not the span of the deal, but do you have any examples of this being done with other riders after potentially they retire or not racing at a high level that's been successful?
No.
Anyone comes to mind?
Not really.
No?
And this is the massive challenge of this, because as soon as a rider becomes kind of average or fodder in the bunch, or heaven forbid starts getting dropped, you're washed. And then you kind of take it. It's brutal, isn't it? Cycling is brutal like that. You immediately don't have the shine that you once had of being dressed in white world champs jerseys, destroying fields. And I don't know what it is about our memories of riders and that kind of, like, even Sagan, like, that you forget, well, you don't forget, but like, Sagan was amazing, absolutely amazing. And yet,
is he moving specialized bikes in 2024? I mean, I feel bad because he's had a heart condition. I saw news popped up, he's had another operation on his heart. So it's kind of, he's got a good excuse as to why he's not out there, you know, pounding the dirt, getting it out there. And so Valverde, he's still Movistar, so he's still Canyon. But, you know, is Valverde in 2024, you know, moving stock off the shelves for Canyon? What's his play? Is Van der Poel going to be off doing Unbound in 2033? Like, what? Is he on YouTube? I mean, I don't know. What? But that's what he'll have to do, because if he ends his road career in 5 or 6 years because there's these 18-year-olds that are just wiping the floor with everyone, he's going to go out there and ride a canyon somewhere. What could you see him doing?
He's so out of touch, Jesse. You got no idea. Yeah, so out of touch. So remember how we always have this chat about why are these guys doing, like, the Pidcocks of this world? Why are they doing the mountain bike stuff? Why is all this cross-discipline thing so quote-unquote cool? Well, because seemingly that's what the bike brands want them to do, and that's what, yes, Van der Poel is the current road world champion, but there've been a lot of road world champions who haven't got 10-year deals with bikes. He's got this deal because, okay, he looks good on a bike. That's, I think, the first one. But also, he's got this broad appeal across these different disciplines. And this kind of, for me, answers the question that who's driving this? Well, it's the bike brands driving this. And I wouldn't be surprised, Jesse. You're not going to like this.
Don't say it.
I'm going to say it.
Oh.
But when this ends, I can see him doing whatever the gravel scene, the premier gravel scene is at that particular moment. I reckon he's going to go full at it.
Oh, man.
Yep. Because that's, you know, if he doesn't have to worry.
He's got a 10-year deal. He can't just go after 7 years, actually, nah, not really interested. I mean, he's got.
No, he's only got 5 years left in the world.
No, but on his Canyon deal.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll have to cart him around the US and do it.
He'd freaking love that. So you don't have to slap yourself through the friggin' Belgian cobbles for half the year. You get to go and hang out in Boulder, Colorado, and, no offense, race some not quite world tour riders and get all the absolute froth and love of that. Yeah,
I guess that'd be
better.
Where
do I sign up for that?
Racing around the slop in Belgium. Yeah. Okay, yep.
So, I mean, yeah, to me this answers that question.
Well, I just find it interesting. I mean, how much – I'd love to see the books from Canyon on Wool in what their potential forecasting is from, let's say, 2030 to 2035. Where's their revenue growth? Like, what? Where are they going to shove them into? Because I laugh now thinking, let's get Mathieu van der Poel to race gravel so he could sell gravel bikes. It seems laughable now, but I mean, you seem pretty convinced that there's a big revenue growth there that is potentially matching the road market. I don't know, but that we'd have to see their books to see where that is. But I mean, it does sound laughable now. But
yeah,
I mean, maybe.
I don't know. I just kind of feel like with the road scene and how ultra competitive that is, yes, Matthew Van Der Poel definitely sells Air Odes for sure, but in 4 or 5 years' time, there could potentially be someone who's can win a couple of monuments on a canyon for them, who can kind of tick that box. So why not ship him out to the US and move that market around Leadville or something like that? I don't know.
As you read out in that press release, they've kind of set him up to do that. They've pretty much said it. They said, well, 5 more years you can do your road thing. Yep. Then it's basically, well, if you read between the lines, it's sort of up to you, but it's also kind of up to us what we want you to do for the next 5 years. You can renew his contract if he wants. Otherwise, we'll fly him around to God knows where just to do any mix of events.
I should add, I did ask a little bit around some of the industry heads. This is unprecedented. Unprecedented in terms of a brand sponsoring an individual that usurps the team. To this extent, it doesn't exist. Even the current crop of the Van Aerts, Jonas, Poggies, they don't have deals with their bike brands that go above and beyond their current team. I mean, they have their bike brands who would be funding some of their salary due to the fact that they fund the team that they're on, but not like this.
Not directly, yeah.
Which brings
He's very deserving. I watched his interview. Canyon put up an interview with him. He's the most likable 100%. Guy. Like, it's money well spent, yeah.
Pro mullet or anti-mullet?
He had a hat on, so I didn't get to see the full good with a hat on, yeah.
All right. Brings me to the question, is there anyone else in the current world tour who you think is deserving of this or is as valuable as this? Because this was kind of interesting. Like, I always thought Poggy was the most marketable person in the sport. Maybe I'm wrong.
He could do it. Carl Nargo, with the backing of the Saudi Investment Fund, whatever that thing's called, they could easily replicate this and have him on as an ambassador once he starts to get washed up. 100%. He could do all the things that Vanderpool does, I reckon. I could easily see him doing,
tour. Would he have the cross-discipline appeal that Vanderpool has? Like, Vanderpool's like going for 7 world cross-world championships, something ridiculous? Like,
well, I mean, no, not in the racing point of view. I mean, I'm not seeing Pogacar going to line up at the, cross-country mountain bike, at the Olympic Games, but as a post Tour de France Valverde era in the potentially gravel scene, yeah, or a Contador Gran Fondo scene sort of thing, 100%.
Fair enough. While we're on it, do you think Van der Poel had any say in Alpecin de Koenig's kit for 2024?
I would think absolutely not.
I don't know what's happened this year. Well, I do know what's happened this year. Everyone's just decided we're going to go to various types of blue and green and look exactly the same as each other. I mean, I know they're trying to do this, denim look. But
yeah.
It literally just looks like, like sublimated Lycra when it's 12 months old and you can just see the white stretchy Lycra underneath it. It just looks like tired, horrible Lycra.
Mm-hmm.
Any thought that it's some textured denim completely goes out the window. I absolutely despise their kit. Despise it.
I don't think you'll find too many people arguing with you there. It also looks they moved the Koenig from de Koenig to Alpecin, then copied the kit. So you've basically got these two teams with similar looking riders with the similar looking kit, who then just seem to just trade back and forth sponsors. That like it's almost a joke. They're basically the same. If it wasn't for Remco Evenepoel and his Belgium national champs kit, you would seriously find it hard to split between the two.
Well, everyone was kind of saying after San Remo, like, oh, I didn't see Philipsen in the group. I didn't see Philipsen because he's in a kit no one can see. It's just like this block of blue behind. No one can actually see anything. And then don't start me on what Decathlon have done. I just do not understand. You just you had finally started Decathlon, creating your own image. You were starting to look cool. You were kind of separating yourselves a bit. And now we've just become a it just looks like a Conti team. I don't know what it is about that kit. It just looks like a Conti team.
It does look like a Conti, yeah.
It's like I've gone to the Quare automatic template designer. My two main colours are green and blue. Insert kit here. And that's what we've come up with. I didn't want to go off on a kit rant there, but I just.
Okay, I thought their original kit they had, I thought it was kind of ugly, but it was ugly in a garish, at least you could see the branding, big Decathlon, and then nice big blocked letters on the sleeve. So at least it had that going for it. Now the logos are just less, they don't stand out as much. So you've got, the pattern, neither here nor there, but the actual logos aren't as big.
Do you know what's going to happen next? So next couple of months, Bora Hansgrohe will do their rebrand to Red Bull. What are the major colours of Red Bull? Blue, silver. No. We're going to have another one. At some point, the UCI have to step in because it's going to be a joke, an absolute joke. This is blue sea. Yeah, anyway. Can we talk about the Poggy love-in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
A quick word from sports micronutrition brand Pillar Performance. Traditional nutrition products like hydration and carbohydrates will take you through to the finish line, whereas Pillar's mission is to get you to the start line in the best condition over and over.
In this episode, Pillar wants to bring awareness to the benefits that magnesium supplementation can have for you as a cyclist, particularly as it relates to sleep and recovery. Do you have trouble getting to sleep each night, or do you suffer from reduced sleep quality, particularly after your biggest training days? If so, magnesium supplementation can help improve all areas of your sleep by regulating melatonin production and reducing cramps that interrupt sleep quality. Pillar's triple magnesium is a 300 milligram blend of absorbable forms of magnesium that tastes great and is Informed Sport batch tested to be free from banned ingredients.
If you would like to try Pillar today, get 15% off by using code Nero at pillarperformance.shop, or for North American viewers and listeners, head to thefeed.com/pillar and enter code Nero for 15% off. Should also mention that UK listeners have had issues with the code in the past. The code is now active again, so you do feel free to go ahead and use it. So I put this in our show notes almost straight after Milan Sanremo. Was a tweet, and the narrative of the tweet is like, the modern day sportsmen, the sportsmanship of these modern athletes, this new generation, is just wonderful. It's love, it's hugs, it's beautiful. And we're obviously alluding to the fact that everyone on the Milan Sanremo podium seemed to be best buds with each other and taking selfies with each other. Now, Lance jumped on this bandwagon. I didn't see any of it, but it was forwarded on to me that he was giving the good old back in my day chat. I didn't need to see it. I know what his rant's going to be.
Yeah.
What's your take on this? Are you going, where are we? Talk to me.
It's a classic Twitter topic where everyone's got an opinion on it. I'm just like, do I really have to? Like, I think it sucks. I don't. You're competitors. You're supposed to, when we're watching a race, we're sitting on the edge of our seat because we know everyone desperately wants a win, and you want to think that they're doing every last thing in the race to get the win, and it's that pressure and that tension that makes cycling good to watch. When they get to the finish line and the top four that were 3 minutes ago about to run each other off the road are hugging and kissing and, oh my God, you did so well. Oh, that's so awesome. I'm like, that's not like, what's going on? Like, that doesn't follow on from what I was expecting to see. So sure, it's nice. I get it. It's a tough sport. It's nice to know they're not at each other's throat. But as a viewer, I want my rivals to be rivals, not mates who are basically treating the race like it's some bunch ride and then just high-fiving each other at the end. I'd prefer if they all hated each other. It'd make the racing better. If I was a pro in the peloton, it's much nicer that you're all friendly, but I'm not a pro in the peloton. I'm a spectator.
Do you think it's real? I almost feel calling bullshit on it.
Yep.
So it's almost so overtly, oh, the boy is so proud of you.
Yeah.
I just call bullshit on it. And part of me thinks it's, well, Poggy's, as he's smart. He's a smooth operator. And he knows that, so again, this is probably an analogy that won't mean anything to you, but Patrick Mahomes is kind of known. He's one of the best quarterback in the NFL. He does this thing where the guys that are trying to tackle him, right, he'll after he gets tackled, he'll say, oh, good tackle, like, well done, mate. Oh, you got me there. Almost trying to create this relationship with the people who are trying to kill him, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it's like I think it's really clever gamesmanship, because you then you're not hated, like Lance said, and then so there could be these moments in this race where maybe it's he breaks away or something, and there could be a moment of, it's Poggy. Gave me a tap on the back. And it's that kind of thing. So a part of me thinks he's playing a really clever game, because there's also a thing with him that his team aren't that style of big bruiser type rider as well. So he'll often need the help, the collusion of others. All I'm trying to say here is I know it's not as matesy as that all played out on the day.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely do feel there's, I mean, a lot of guys hate Jasper Philipsen and they hate the way he rides and they think he is fucking dangerous.
Yep.
And to be patting him on the back after the race, I know did annoy quite a few people. So, yeah, I think, and lastly, the thing with Lance. So Lance went on his rant about back in my day, blah, 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 hated. There is the fact is the world has moved on and even Lance has moved on. Like the people that Lance hated at the time, he's now matesy with, because that's what people want to see. They don't like if Lance still held this massive grudge against Jan Ulrich and was not talking to him, everyone would be sort of like, get over it, mate. It was 30 years ago. So I don't know. I just feel like he's sort of matured a bit, as well as everyone else in professional sport.
Mm.
Yeah,
I get you. Did you see the stage, the Catalunya stage, where Nick Schultz broke away,
mm-hmm.
and then Poggy launched his sprint
mm-hmm.
late after having no one else to chase and almost caught him but didn't catch him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I watched that.
Mm-hmm.
And then apparently at the finish line, like, Poggy congratulated him and seemed to be happy for him. Like, but no. I don't want Poggy to be happy. I want Poggy to be sitting there going, oh, fucking, where's my teammates? I could have won that. So, like, I don't want him going over and being like, oh, you know, great ride. Like, good for you. Where's the tension in that?
Do you think he was like that in the bus, though? Do you think he was back in the bus and was like, ah, oh, geez, I'm so happy for Nick Schultz. What a great win from him. Or do you reckon he was like, where the fuck were you, Hershey? Like, come on. So, yeah.
Well, it's not. Well, if that happened at the Tour de France, he probably would be. I don't know. What do you? He just genuinely seemed. I'm not saying it for Poggy. I don't know. I wouldn't say it's not genuine. I reckon he most of the time he is being genuine with that. But then that spreads to the other ones.
Yes, there
and
is.
And then you're
yes.
sort of like, are you in? Because when you're, especially when you're in the peloton too, that you when you're repeating some of the races, there's this, the bubble of the same riders, because there can only be 10 riders in the top 10. So. And it's always generally the same riders. And if they're all matesy, you end up with this kind of like bubble of Philipsen. Probably not even Philipsen. I don't know why I said that. Like Poggy's genuinely mates with Matthews. And then like Poggy and Vanderpool have like a thing. And then it's kind of like, who, you know, are you in the club that can kind of sit up in the top 10? And they'd probably give each other a bit more space. I don't like it.
I agree. I don't like it. I do feel that he's pulling one. This is his personality, but I think he is He's using this as a sporting advantage or a competitive advantage very, very cleverly.
And yeah. Whether he's doing it on purpose or not, I don't know. It's also very good for his publicity, for the public image. When it comes out in the articles, Nick Schultz wins, and then it's, you know, Pogacar was, you know, congratulated him across the, you know, after the line. Like, it sounds really good. It's good for his stock.
Is there potential for any of these riders to become a bit of to try and bring back the bad boy? I mean,
it doesn't work because sort of the Vingegaard thing is that he's just this cold, sort of heartless, you know, boring dude that doesn't get along with anyone. Is it not working? Maybe not the right way. He's winning the Tour of France, so it's in the public realm. It's not working for Vingegaard to not be in the boys' club.
Yeah. Outside of your Danish fans,
Exactly. I'm sure if Vingegaard was you know, hand slaps and you know, pats on the back with the boys after the stages, he'd have a lot more fans. But he's a real guy and he doesn't like not winning. Yeah. I am glad to see that this little love in hasn't spread to the sprinters. I still think I haven't really seen this at the end of a 70K an hour downhill sprint.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Seemed to have spread, yeah. We talked a few weeks about the Thomas de Gendt's the hookless blowout, which was got widespread coverage. So turns out, Zip have updated, it wasn't a hookless blowout.
Yeah, I saw this.
It was a rim failure. So there's an article here, Cycling News, Zip releases photos debunking hookless rim failure after de Gendt crash. And Zip has put up here photos of the destroyed rim, basically saying it wasn't an issue with the hookless tyres. The reason why he crashed and there was a blowout of the tyre was because the rim was cracked. And I am almost quite set aback.
Is this better or worse?
Well, that is a bloody good question. As far as I'm concerned, it's better to have the tyre blow off because you weren't running them within the specifications of what you were supposed to, then have the rim fail. Questions. There's a lot more questions that come up from this. So the actual crash, so if we just actually circle back to what happened, well, he crashed in the UAE Tour, but it wasn't a crash where he rode into a massive pothole, has sort of flung over the handlebars, and then you've gone, oh, the bike's just completely cooked, and then you would sort of understand if the rim's cracked. He was basically riding along and, you know, something's happened with the front wheel. So the wheel was either cracked before at some earlier part of the stage or as cracked as he's riding along and then he's crashed, right? So the thing is they're saying, well, he had an impact with a rock or there was an impact that was at fault. Since the crash, De Gendt, Zip and Vittoria have all confirmed in separate statements that an impact was at fault. Each has referenced an errant rock as the guilty party, but so far there's been no evidence. Today that changes. So they've shown the photos of the rim.
So that's the evidence of a rock, is it?
Well, that's the evidence that he's hit a rock and the rim's cracked. So, I mean, the problem is it wasn't a single massive impact and then he's then come off the bike. He was just riding along and... So he's either directly hit a rock and that's then blown the tire, cracked the rim, blown the tire off, and then caused the crash. In which case, you're going, well, how is an impact with a rock that wasn't hard enough to send him down in one big impact enough to crack the rim?
So you want me to believe that racing through the UAE, correct, on those hot mix surfaces, big wide roads, that a professional cyclist just runs over what is must have been a boulder at this point.
To crack a rim.
To crack a rim.
Because now, these rims do get tested. They are impact tested from the manufacturers. So he must have hit. This is what I don't get. If you've hit, as you're saying, if you've hit something with enough force, I mean, we've ridden out, you hit some massive fuckers that could send you over the handlebar, your rims don't crack.
Rims don't crack.
So he's hit something enough to just crack this rim straight down the middle. Apparently, that hasn't been enough for him to come off in that impact. He's then fallen off because the tire's blown off due to the cracked rim, and then that's made him crash? If so, I mean, don't Zip have a lot more to answer for as to why is your rim cracking on an impact that wasn't enough to crash the rider, but's been enough to crack the rim?
I watched quite a few cobbled semi-classics over the last 10 to 12 days, and there were some pretty horrendous cobbles and rocks that some of those guys were hitting. Even Paris-Roubaix, they are horrendous. So you're telling me, he wasn't in the break, was he?
Nope.
At the time.
Sitting in a bunch.
The other 130 guys missed this enormous boulder. He's managed to hit it, snapped his front rim completely. I don't know. There's a lot of circumstances here, the location of it, the geography of it, the race setting of it that makes this, yeah. I mean, I don't want to, I mean, yeah, I no, actually, I have not cracked a rim. Actually, no, I have not cracked a rim.
No?
So maybe, geez, I have hit some big freaking rocks in my time.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm just, for those of that are listening, and I'm sure Chris will put up a photo of the rim, but I'm telling you, this rim is snapped in half. Like, that's the photo they've provided.
That's the kind of rim that you would see after a massive pile-up in the bunch where your wheel just goes absolutely careering into someone else's head tube at 70 k's an hour minimum. Yeah. Or, no, you hit a car is actually what that is.
Like a sudden, you've gone from 55 to zero to do that. That I can't see a wheel that's made it through Zip's testing procedure for the strength of the rim that's having that happen, hitting something that hasn't then crashed you. So, I mean, the point of this segment was to clarify that apparently, according to what they say, I was not correct the other week when I said it was a hookless blow-off. It wasn't just the tire blowing off, but I honestly think this is a worse reflection on the Zip rims than just having the tire blow off. Because they were using a tire that was too narrow.
Yes.
So they had you had an excuse of how that could have happened. I don't know. I don't know what's going on here.
What's the zoomed in picture here that they've got? So they've seemingly got a picture of, oh, that's his rim.
Yeah.
So that's in the race.
That's in the race. That's it there. So if you
zoom
right
in. So it's
not
blown off at this point.
No, that's off. See, it's coming. That's over the rim on this side. So that's the bead of the tire.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, I see.
And that's the crack. So,
yeah, look at all those boulders on the road on that hot mix fast surface.
I mean, something doesn't add up.
Where's the GoPro footage?
Well,
that's the big one. That's the one I'm waiting for. What do we got? We got a Hero 8. So that's, you know, no issues there. That'll pick that up. Nice little hyper view, definitely. Where is that GoPro footage? Will we ever see it?
So Hambini also did a video that came out. Hambini did a video looking at a hooked versus a hookless rim, so comparing a Zip to a Windspace, about a week before this article came out and Zip clarified that the rim broke. And he was kind of showing that with the hookless rim, because there's less material to make the hook, there's less material on the hookless rim compared to the hooked, that it's actually not that stiff. He's kind of squeezing it going, there's not a lot of give here. There's a lot of give here in this rim. So He had concerns just with the structural integrity of the actual rim, given that there's less material. In his opinion, it's not stiff enough. There's not enough material there. So I don't know. I still think this wasn't just a pure hookless blowout. This rim was cracked. How did it crack? They just said, well, you hit a rock and the rim cracked.
You've been big on this recently, though. You're starting to walk into this sort of territory of just how safe is some of the stuff we're riding in 2024, and more concerningly with the way we're now heading towards lighter and lighter disc brake bikes, the actual structural integrity.
With the frames? That was another consideration I had. So anyway, just to wrap up, I'll get on to that, but just on these rims, we probably won't hear any more about this rim. I still think there's questions to be answered here. How did this rim crack just from a seemingly impact that wasn't enough to send him over the handlebars? We don't know. But it's not, as far as I'm concerned, that's not a good look for Zip. The rims are cracking. And yes, as it comes to the wheels potentially getting lighter so they can keep the weights down while still having enough reinforcement for the disc brakes, and same with the frames. My concern that is coming up with the frames is this Giant comes out and they've got it's the lightest ever TCR, they say. And we've got these new technologies in the way the carbon's cut so that the wall thickness of the tubes in the places we don't need it to be stiff are as thin as ever. And it's the new thing is kind of the wall thickness. We get this thing down to there's one sheet of carbon there and allows us to create this amazing stiff super light frame. But nowhere in the press releases of these things is how impact resistant is this top tube? Is this chainstay? Is the seat stay? It's all just how stiff is it, and then how light is it, and how aerodynamically shaped? Because then you've got not just making it super stiff and light, you're then also trying to shape it into an aerodynamic shape to save some watts. So then you're kind of stretching it out in that dimension, which should make it heavier. So then you've got to make it even lighter. So I just have I'm not quite convinced that what's going to happen in a couple of years' time where you've got a 550-gram disc brake aero-featured frame. Now, it might pass – I'm not saying it's just going to explode as you're riding along, because it will have to pass their impact testing standards that happen in all the directions, the impact of the fork, the seat post and all that. So it'll test that before it gets released. But what about in every other direction? You're clamping it onto your bike stand, or just, as plenty of people say, it falls over at the cafe, or you have a bit of a stack at the lights, and then you've got a seat stay that's two plies of carbon thick so they can keep the frames getting lighter.
And it's not something you really ever see in a press release or a bike review of how crash resistant is the Merida Sculptura 8000. Well, it's 6 stars. You know, I mean, a car, do we still do it? I'm sure we still do it with cars. You have the crash rating, the crash test dummy.
Yes.
You know, if you head on, this is your status. You know, I would actually, that would factor in definitely for me, especially if I was buying a bike that I was traveling with, all that kind of stuff. How impact resistant is my bike? And I don't even know, is a lighter frame, higher grade carbon bike less impact resistant? I don't really know. I just would have assumed it is, because it's potentially, like you said, got thinner walls, but maybe it isn't. Maybe a higher grade carbon is more crash resistant. Well, I don't know.
I mean, the reason why you don't know is because no manufacturer discusses it. I don't think they would even factor it. They're just going, well, it needs to be stiff enough to pass the test that we have to do for the frame to be sold, so it's safe. Beyond that, is it if I'm putting in the back of the car and put a suitcase on the rear triangle, is it going to snap the tube? I don't think they care. So I don't think it is tested for. And just with you know, disc brakes came in, then the frames, everyone's trying to get them more aero, so they're stretching out the tubes. Then they're trying to get them lighter. And with advancements in the the actual carbon technology to do that, what happens? I just have a question over that. Can we see some?
Very good question.
Over that,
it segues really well into subscriber question.
Okay,
can I go with that?
Yeah, let's go.
Because I don't have a huge amount to add to what you mm-hmm. brought up, but let's go. Subscriber question.
Hey guys, Vinny here, loving the podcast. My question is, as a beginner cyclist who is trying to look for the bike that would fit me, how would I understand descriptive terms that YouTube bike reviewers use, like stiffness versus compliance, speed, things like that, and aero? How do we understand that as a cyclist if, say, I'm a professional musician by trade, and if I want to buy a guitar, I can search it up on YouTube and listen to it and judge my purchase or my future purchase upon that. But if it's a bike, it's really hard to understand the descriptive terms. So my question is, I want to buy a bike. How do I understand bike reviews? Thanks, guys.
It's because the descriptive terms are bullshit. They don't mean anything.
What do you got? What do you got? Come on. What's your honest opinion on this? Impossible?
I'll answer. Just go and test ride and buy the one that is most fun to ride. I mean, you can't. Okay. What riding are you doing? That's the first thing. Like, how do I judge what someone's descriptive kind of description of the speed is or the aero? Well, what are you doing? 27k an hour club rides? Aero, just irrelevant. Don't worry about it. So you have to know what are you trying to do with the bike first before we could even, you know, I don't know who the rider is. What do you want the bike to be good at? So that would be done. Otherwise, you kind of, if you're just a rider and you haven't really sat down and considered what do you want your bike to be good at, how are you ever going to reach a conclusion?
So my take with this is, and I get asked, this is like the $1 million question I get asked all the time about, should I get this bike? Should I get that bike? I've heard it's too stiff. Oh, I've heard it's blah, 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 blah. The most valuable thing a YouTube review can give you is what the bike looks like. Whether or not you like mm-hmm. the way that bike looks, mm-hmm. that is the best thing a YouTube video can give you. Beyond that, it's basically hearsay. Now, that's not true. You know, a GC performance video shows you how much an exact bike build weighs. That's a thing. You can look at that. Then you can look what it looks like. Everything else, Grant says, love Grant. You take it with a pinch of salt. And that goes for absolutely everybody. Because the way you experience a bike, just like Jesse said, is entirely different to the way that the bike reviewer does. I mean, I don't know how far I want to go into these terms.
Well, let's go through the terms. So what were the terms you
said? Let's start with stiffness.
Well, then you first have to look, well, what's your power? Like, are you ever doing more than 800 watts? Well, most of the bikes are going to be stiff enough from a performance point of view. Now, does a stiffer bike feel more responsive when you ride it? You might enjoy that. So you then have to factor in, well, the stiffer bikes might be more enjoyable to ride, but is that going to make a performance difference? Probably not, unless you're, you know, really strong. So,
and I'll throw another one into the mix. Often the way the bike reacts comes down to the geometry of the bike. So a shorter mm-hmm. wheelbase can give you the feeling of a stiff bike because it feels more reactive. And so there you start going down a different rabbit hole there. And also the fact that if you're in an aggressive position on the bike, so if you're low down in the drops, if you're able to maintain a position like that because the bike has a little bit more compliance, which we'll get into, again, you could feel like the bike is stiffer because you're down low, you're in a good position to sprint, and then you put a few watts through the pedals and it feels stiff to you, as opposed to a rock solid bulk stiff bike where you're sitting really upright on it. It might not actually have that kick to it. Compliance.
Well, just on the stiffness, you can also, it would change over years. If you're looking at someone's review and they did one in 2020 and one in 2024. And you're going, well, in 2020, he said the air road was not that stiff. And then in 2024, he rode an SL8 and said it's really stiff. That's not worth anything. Who does those videos? Like a bike radar or whatever it is. And they're testing multiple bikes at the same time. And then the presenter can come on, and assuming they're not lying and they have half a brain, they can go on and say, well, I rode the air road and the S5 and I felt like the air road was stiffer. Well, I will, you know, put some weight into that.
Yep. Yep.
Or just ignore it and go look up tour magazines.
Yeah. Compliance is a really muddy one as well. I would describe compliance as ride feel.
Yeah.
I think.
So would I.
And, you know, obviously there's so much that goes into that: tire pressure, wheels, saddle, geometry, all those kind of things. But ultimately, how well a bike soaks up the vibrations of the road and feeds that back through your butt and your back would be how I would describe compliance.
What riding are you doing? Exactly. If you do 90-minute to 3-hour club rides, you will probably not really care compared to the other characteristics. If you're going and doing 6-hour Grand Fondos, you should be putting more consideration into the compliance. It depends on what riding you're doing.
I realize this isn't being particular, but we talked about this the other week, like my crimes against aero bikes. Think about the way you ride, the way you ride your rides. We all tend to have a dozen bike rides we do. Just it's the nature of our lives. Think about the way you ride those particular bits of terrain. Do you maintain power consistently over it and pedal on the downhill? That's when you really feel the speed of an aero bike. Or do you just want to slam it up 800 meters up that little hill? Then maybe the aero bike type thing isn't for you.
What power is your threshold? 220 watts? Well, it's not going to make much of a difference, if any. So that factors into it. And plus then, like someone saying a bike, we've proven multiple times that someone saying, you know, the bike's so good, you can just feel it's faster, and then you go look up Tour Magazine's testing and it's the same. So in terms of aero, I would say aero would be the hardest thing for someone to feel.
100%.
Out of any of the things.
100%.
Just look up the testing. If you think that aero is going to matter for you, just look up the testing. Someone saying it feels fast is just next to useless. So, yes, for aero, just look up the testing if you care, I would say. And then look up, well, then the specs matter. You know, what are the wheels? It's even the fact that, like, speed and aero is so far up the list of what someone would be considering to buy a new bike is like, is criminal of the bike industry. I don't know how fast this person rides. I'm guessing their threshold isn't over 300 watts. The fact that that's up there with, he hasn't even mentioned like specs of what it is. That speed aero is sort of up there with how the bike rides is kind of mind blowing. But
biggest factor for the majority of people riding bikes, I honestly do feel, is the reactivity of a bike. And I saw this explained really well by Ben Delaney. He went on a bike ride with Dave Arthur on their little junket out to Taiwan, and they did a nice little ride vlog. And Delaney took a moment to describe some of the terms that he uses in bike reviews. And one of the ones was the nimbleness and snappiness and why they use those words. And a lot of it came down to the angle of the head tube. And he was basically explaining that the steeper the head tube, the more reactive and snappy a bike will feel. The more relaxed that becomes, the more sort of laid out you become, the slower but the more planted you feel on the road. And I thought that was really well described. And there, to me, that's the first sensation you will get on a road bike, because there you are, you're planted in this sort of aggressive position on a road bike if you've come from something else, and you are confronted with this very aggressive feeling. And that, to me, that head tube angle is something that's really, really important.
And you'd be tempted to say, oh, it's a rocket ship.
Mm.
But okay. Could you think of a less, like, what is it? Oh, it's a rocket. Like, how many times have we heard that? Like, what does that mean? It's a rocket ship. I don't know. Bike shops still do test riding. I was out walking around, coming back from a cafe the other day, and I saw a guy from our local shop. He was test riding a Cervelo R5. So test rides still exist.
I will say Giant are another one that will do it. Yep. Some of the Giant shops here in Australia will do it. Mm-hmm. I do know that the Trek stores in the US do them.
They do? Okay.
I'm not sure about here. Trek, 100%. Yeah. They still exist.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I think instead of like, I mean, maybe the brands that you're looking at, you can't test ride, which would be frustrating, but just test. You don't have to wonder what term someone, what do they mean when they say that? Like, how does that, is that more of a rocket ship than that? Like, how much of a rocket ship is it? If you can test ride it, you can go and experience it for yourself.
Or just do what I said in the very beginning and buy the bike that looks the coolest. Honestly, like I
do not do that.
I do feel that
that's
a lot of
the
people,
worst
if,
idea.
If it means that that person is more likely to go and get on their bike than just buy the bike that looks the coolest, suffer your back injuries. actually, that was interesting. So a lot of people warned me about riding the, and I almost warned myself about riding the S5 at Peaks. Because I do get, as I was saying, there's like 3 or 4 hours, my back starts to get like, oh, God, this is tough. But you forget that the riding we do in around Sydney is a lot of the time you're planted down in the drops. You're not really out of the saddle for long periods. And I'm certainly not climbing up on the tops very long.
No.
Whereas at that 7.5 hour Peaks thing, you are. You're in these multitude of different positions on the bike. And I didn't actually have any. I had way less back issues at Peaks than I did 7 days later just riding 3 hours around Sydney.
Hmm.
So, again, that just shows, think about the kind of riding that you're doing and the positions that you're in.
You're doing an Alpine Gran Fondo? Ride a super aero bike.
Oh, and you can look at, like, a lot of the power, like, even the Axis does this, and if you have the power meter pedals, a lot of them will show you, like, how long do you spend out of the saddle and all this sort of stuff. It's kind of interesting data if you're actually looking into what type of riding you do.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a few weeks talking a bit, biting your ear off about my riding. I haven't talked much about Jay Coyle's riding lately.
Oh, it's a fascinating story.
Is it a fascinating story? What's going on? Talk me through it here. Are we at the crossroads? Break it down.
We're not at the crossroads.
You can share it.
No. Anytime I've done an event in the past, it's like an excuse to train. And then the event, doing the race or whatever, is like a cherry on top. You're sitting very, I feel very, like I'm seeing my therapist. You've come right in. You're freaking me out. But I'm not sure what to do now because I don't have as much time to train. So in the next 6 months, if I do an event or something, it's not going to be an excuse to train because I'm not going to be training that much. I can still do some riding, but it's not an excuse to train. So then I'm looking at it going, I'm going to have to do what most people do now and probably pick an event to do for the pure pleasure of just doing it, not because it gives me something to train for, which I have literally never done ever in my cycling career, has picked an event just to go and ride the bike. So do you have ideas for me?
Just coming back to it, so you said you choose an event as an excuse to train. So by that, do you mean you would choose an event and then that becomes your focus and your reason for going and doing, let's say you do a 6 week like training block. And that is that what you mean?
But the point of, so in the past, the point of doing the event was probably 90% just so I could train for it. And that was what I enjoyed.
Oh.
And then you just did, I kind of went and did the event just to see how I go and for competitiveness and that's the thing. But if I hadn't done the training in the past, usually I wouldn't just go and do the event just for the sake of doing the event. Whereas now I'm in the situation of, well, if I'm not going and doing any, traveling to any events, just for the sake of doing them, I will literally not do anything.
I won't do
anything.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, what should I do? What is the best event to do just for the sake of doing it? Because there's different avenues. I know you're going to say gravel.
No.
No, you're not?
No, okay. No, God, no.
So
I
do
would,
you go...
I would never suggest just okay. the oil, thus good. The gravel of it, for the safety of everyone else around you.
So, yeah, so it's, you know, do I...
Shut up. Honestly, just shut up, toughen up, deal with it. You will notice very little difference to every other event you go to. It's just you'll turn up and instead of riding away from everyone, you might be in the third group or something like that. And I understand what you're saying about the preparation factor. That will probably be, for yourself, be hard to overcome because you are so normally so focused in the preparation of an event that you are able to you're able to grow your fitness over that particular period of time. That's going to be the biggest challenge for you, definitely. I don't think the actual event's going to be that different for you.
Really? So Snowy Classics on this weekend, right? And I've been riding like four times a week, three times a week for an hour at best. So you're telling me I should go to Snowy Classic on Saturday and just ride it for the fun of it?
No.
What's the best event to do that's not gravel, but just because it's fun?
None.
Because I don't know, because I've never done something just for fun. So I don't even know what I would enter.
Mm. For you, none. I don't think you should go to any.
but then all I do is ride around in Centennial Park three times a week. There are quite a lot, I'd say, I mean, that's not true. Most people doing some events, even if they're going slower, are training for them. But there is a group of, pretty big group of people that just do events just because it's fun.
100%. Yep.
What should be my, what should be my first one I do just for fun? That's giving me the best chance of going, yeah, you know what? I didn't train for that. I did no preparation, but I was really worth going. Like, it should be something really hard.
Yeah.
So that it's just an absolute.
Well, it's somewhere. Like it's got to be
a endorphin rush of suffering.
It can't be somewhere you've been before, and you can therefore compare yourself to fit trained Jesse. Personally, I think it needs to be a totally unique experience.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it is something like a Peaks Challenge or something like that that does take you out of that comfort zone, puts you in a different environment, and you can just go and suffer alone and be in that space in your head that you can't experience. Because, yeah, like that's the best part of these events. From my experience and my takeaway is it's not the camaraderie, fine, talk to people whenever. it's the suffering alone in like just crazy unique environments.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah, I mean, gravel probably gives you more of a – that's more accessible because you probably don't have to ride for 7 hours to find yourself in that location. But for someone who's going to ride on the road, I think something like Peaks can definitely give you that experience. And you would come away from that absolutely like you've had a unique experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Snow. I wouldn't recommend you go to Snowy Classic. No.
No. Okay.
No. Or even like the barrel type things. Something totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what is it? So if you're going, it's for the euphoria of the suffering. That's really satisfying, even if you.
We just don't have many of those here.
Well, that's the
other
there's
problem.
Not a lot. No. Yeah.
It's really a pity that the tap doesn't exist anymore. And I wouldn't suggest you go and do, we'll talk about this next week or some other time, but I wouldn't suggest you go do like actual races. Mate,
yeah, so an actual race.
Maybe an actual race. Hmm. Yeah.
Like a state handicap.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the problem is, can I start in not in scratch? Can I go
Fuck
in,
no.
Can I go in group three?
No. I've seen,
oh, well.
I've seen your 1 hour a week rides and what you can do. Yeah, but no, I don't think that would be as, because you've suffered through the odd ones of those as well in the past, so it's not like that's a particular unique experience for you. It doesn't have to be Peaks. There's quite a few other ones like the Alpine Classics and the Fitz's Challenges and all these sort of things that are just, I don't know, puts you in a bit of a different environment. I think that's the kick up the ass that you might need, actually. At some point, I do want to talk a bit more about like the state of road racing in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I have asked some of the people who put some of the events on just to, in terms of some of the finances and everything involved in actually doing it. So we'll do that next couple of weeks. But I should say, and I know that the narrative in the US is that the road racing scene is dead, but they really do a great job. With people just riding their bikes over there seem to do a really good job of just shooting, making content of any damn road race or crit race there is. I swear if I went and, well, I actually know this, that if I went to do a road race in NorCal or SoCal, I could probably find someone doing that exact event at some point in the last decade and look at the entire course and some of the tactics that plays out on it. So I don't know whether that's one of the reasons we're not very good here about actually promoting races, because we don't tend to make content ourselves about it. But anyway.
Well, no one goes to them.
No one goes to them.
Well, that's, I mean,
but it's all,
people
it's
have
like
to this, show up to film them.
But then it's like the circle is that if you have people making content about it and you see it, then the next year they go, oh, I saw that one about the road race in Canberra. I'm definitely going to go and do that. Whereas I reckon that happens in the US. It's just this continues to flow, and you've seen the guy racing Cat 4 at it the previous year because you saw that YouTube video, and then the next year you're going to go and be there. So I don't know.
Are we not going to go into that this week?
I just don't have the numbers on it.
Don't have the numbers on it.
So I've asked the Bicycle Network guys about what's involved financially, logistically, essentially what it costs to put Three Peaks on, and the same with some of the state races. And we even asked one of the people who used to run one of the state races here, the Nowra one, why that died, like what happened financially there. So when I get some of that information back, I'll hopefully be able to talk about it with a bit more certainty. Apart from that, Jesse, so we have started publishing the show a day earlier. So from my perspective, it's my daughter now goes to swim school on Thursday, so it kind of logistically has made sense from that perspective. But it would be remiss to say, not remiss, but there's the other aspect of, okay, we were doing the show 6 months before Cade, but then they started putting their show up an hour before us. It's free country, whatever, you don't really care. But they did. And I don't know how you feel about it, but I kind of still feel like the audience is probably a little bit different. That said, two cycling podcasts going up on the same day, almost the same hour, be good to have a little bit of separation. So
I think it's different audience, but the cycling YouTube's small. I guarantee there's quite a few people that will be watching this now. There's probably a Cade Media video or their podcast somewhere in the recommendations feed. So there would definitely be crossover.
Yeah.
Separate days is just spreads it all out a little bit.
Well, so she's in swim school for another 3 months. So probably for the next 3 months, we'll definitely try and do the day earlier, and then after that, kind of have a look at where we're at. But to this point, we'll stick with a Thursday? I think it's a Thursday.
Yep.
All right. Any other news, gossip, innuendo?
Nothing.
All right. We will. We'll see you all next week, guys. Thanks very much.
See you then.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.